Hey there. Daniel Markham here at DanielBMarkham.com. Today is Nerd Roundup. And Nerd Roundup, if you haven't been here before, we try to do it at the end of each week. And we like to model the behavior you want to see in teams. And good teams are relaxed. They're able to kick back over the coffee counter and talk about dang near anything. And so I had the honor and privilege of talking to some of my tech friends about dang near anything. I have a new guest on today, Mark Danziger. I'm going to flip over in just a second. Mark is one of the few people that I have known that's been able to go online and have conversations with people of various widely dispersed opinions without it turning into a flame war. I know it does sometimes, but he's really, really good at working the internet. He's really, really good at processes. He's good at strategic management consulting. I don't think he's that good of a COBOL programmer anymore, but we'll cut him some slack. And I also have James Grinney, who has been here the last couple weeks or so. And so without further ado, here we go. Greetings, guys.
Hey.
Howdy, Dan.
So howdy. What has everybody been up to this week?
I've been recovering from a sprint to wrap up a client contract and negotiating another contract. And regretting some of my life choices because most of my contracts are with giant corporations. And the process of contracting with, you know, a Fortune 100 corporation is challenging.
So let me get that. You've been on a sprint to write a contract to be on a sprint to write contracts?
Is that good? You're wishing we were doing COBOL again now?
So Mark, you're not extremely technical. You do a lot of tech consulting, but, you know, you're not like a heavy nerd coder.
I used to be. I was, once upon a time, I was a technical guy. And my arc is sort of funny. I lived in college down the hall from a guy who was a grad student who was building stuff, and I built a bunch of Heathkits. Remember Heathkits?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
So I built a bunch of Heathkits. So I wound up kind of helping him out, and he started a company and dragged me along with him. And so I did a startup as a freshman in college that turned into a kind of a giant company. There's a sad story about my having to leave because my parents wouldn't sign my stock paperwork.
wow.
but I'd always been kind of interested in tech, but I'd also, you know, my first job out of school was in politics. And then I worked in banking, and then I worked in investment banking. And then one day I'm in my little investment banking suit, and I just couldn't get on the elevator. I didn't want to do it anymore. And I quit, and I opened up a little consulting shop. And somebody, after I did a bunch of investment banking type work, somebody hired me to write a program for them because I'd always written programs. I was like a hobbyist programmer, you know, writing things in Turbo Pascal. Yeah. And the guy paid me, and I was like, wait, I can get paid for this? Huh. This is crazy.
That was my revelation.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Why would they do that? Why would people give me money? This is insane.
I know. And so I took about a 90% cut in pay and switched over to programming and was a baby programmer and wrote a couple of cool programs. I wrote a program that did stress analysis of pipes and displayed it graphically, which was one of the early kind of graphic displays of something. And it won like an award someplace and for the Metropolitan Water District in L.A. And then I sort of, because I could talk to people and could talk business and, you know, wasn't a complete introvert, I pretty soon wound up being the bridge between the programmers and the business, which sometimes looked like business analysis and sometimes looked like project management and sometimes looked like architecture and other sorts of things. And did that for a long time and got pretty good at it. And that sort of, you know, put me on the path I'm at the end of now.
Yeah, I'm kind of like with you. I really love that point right there where the tech meets the business. It's that little sort of crisis point where cool stuff happens there.
Well, the thing I talk about, and I used to give a talk to developers when I had sort of these tiger teams because I always was like the guy dealing with crisis, right? And I always made the point to them that this business does something with technology that makes it money. Right. We're working for Cars Direct. So they sell cars. Right. Yep. And I'm like, if there was a way that they could sell cars with hamsters and cages instead of technology, you and I would be walking around a building with 50-pound bags of hamster chow. Yeah. Right. And so it's kind of important to keep in mind that, like, we're not here to do cool tech. We're here to help the company make money with business, which often involves doing cool tech. But you got to keep the end in mind.
you know, we've got a thing called YAGNI. You ain't going to need it when we're coding. And I find that people say that over and over again, but they don't really get it. It's like the business has a need. Think of it as a string. And that string is pulling out what we need to pull out of the tech to make that happen. If you think of I'm building this without that string involved, there's no limit to the amount of complexity you can put in there.
Well, and there's this horrible problem, and I see it in so many people. I actually had a guy on my team in this last thing I was on, and I sort of called him on it, and he sort of rat holes into the computer. You know, you get really involved in doing some cool technical thing in the computer. In his case, he's building these insane Excel pivot documents with he had like a 60 meg Excel, you know, thing that he built.
There should be a limit on that.
What are you doing? Right? Like, why is this any good for anybody? He goes, well, I can optimize. And I go, you could do 90% of what you're doing with something that you could have done in like a day. And it's now taking you a month. And so what? Help me understand the point here. Like, get out and go talk to people.
Yeah, that's one of those things that the engineers will go chase down something fun just because it's fun.
Well, there's no feedback loop there except for fun and more fun and more fun. And if you like technical things like we do, it's just the more you do it, the more you really want to create the tech. And it's
it's awesome. And if somebody will pay me to sit there in front of my screen and do that, you know, I can imagine how you'd fall down it. The problem is they won't pay you to do that forever.
Last week, James and I were talking.
Unless you work for a big company, and then you could be on a four year project that doesn't do anything. And,
you can hide,
and then you can keep your job after it fails too. So,
I worked on this project once. It was 1,200 consultants working for the government. And it was this huge, huge thing. Oh my god,
the government can waste money in very special ways.
And so, I was head of the architecture team for my division. I went to this called architecture group, and there was just a table full of people that did nothing but make things complicated for other people. I was like, wow. I didn't like that too much, but it was sort of breathtaking. Like, wow, boy, there's just no feedback at all here.
No, there's none. There's no feedback. There's no connection to the customer. There's no connection to value.
So we did this gig where we worked with the Department of State and the FBI, and it's interdisciplinary, and you know, all this kind of stuff. So we're doing this kickoff meeting. And this guy starts pitching the idea of rewriting FTP. Because had to have really secure connections, and wouldn't it be cool to rewrite FTP? I
mean, yeah.
It might be awesome. I don't know, but we're not going to do that.
No, I've had guys who come out, and they're doing that same thing. It's like, I'm going to take this foundational component, and I've got a way to make it so much better. And I'm like, why? Yeah. And the way I deal with it, my wife and I just finished watching the last season of the TV series Bosch.
Oh, yeah. Good show.
Yep.
It's a good show. My wife is interesting. I'm married to a woman with the artistic taste of a 14-year-old boy. And so basically, if there are guns and shooting involved in it, she's all about it. And, you know, I, on the other hand, I'm all like, I want to watch my dinner with Andre, right? It's just different.
You have your roles reversed.
But the thing I love in Bosch, if you remember, he's got this thing on his desk, this poster, which says, get off your ass and go knock on doors.
Yes. Yep.
Right. And I literally will
Don't spoil the last season yet because I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah. Okay. I won't tell you what happens. But but what I do is I have like a picture of his desk with that poster on it. And I very often will put it up on like the task board of teams that I'm working in. Because it's like, why are you sitting in front of your computer? Why aren't you out talking to people?
Yeah.
Right. And when you talk to enough people that you know what's going on, then go sit in front of your computer.
Or the extended version of this is you tell them to go talk to people, and so they get out of their cube, they go down to the other programmer's cube, and then the programmers talk. It's like, no, guys, no. It's just you're making this worse. Really, stop doing that.
Yeah, back in the 80s at the company that Bob Martin and I worked at, the product managers kept trying to get us to go into the field. Well, actually, Bob probably didn't have a problem, but the group I was with, it's like, you got to go talk to the customer. It's like, no, we know what we're doing. And then we went out and talked to the customer. It's like, holy cow.
We don't.
No. We had no idea how they were using our product. And
so it's funny because a friend of mine worked for a big retailer right in Seattle. I won't name names. And he was sort of like a agile lead program manager type guy over all their customer service kind of software. Well, it turns out the actual floors with the customer service reps on it were two floors up from where his people were. And he gets there and he goes, well, have we gone up and talked to them? And they all look at him like, why would we do that? We have requirements. We know what we're building. and like literally, he like said, okay, shut off your computers. Come with me. They walked up two floors of stairs, you know, walked out onto the floor. And he said, I want you to pick somebody, sit with them for 2 hours. You know, and that, and made that like a regular kind of heartbeat thing that they did. And it was transformative. I mean, it made more difference in what they did and impact on the ultimate customer and the CSRs than kind of anything else they could have done. And it, you know, it cost them walking up two flights of stairs.
So I was interviewing a client in Dallas, Texas. They were an insurance company. I think they had 200 or 300 employees, kind of a small thing. And I asked the IT department, which was having a lot of problems, like, have you guys talked to your, you know, I'm sorry, what sort of interaction have you had with the customer service reps? And the guy was like, you know, we used to see them all the time, but then we put that key card system in so keep them out of the shop. Because then we just show up and complain about stuff all the time.
The key card system is working great.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I'm not sure you're doing this.
And there's a part of it, I think.
Are you solving the right problem? Just wondering, you know.
The part of it is sociological, right? It's like the people who self-select into, you know, engineering roles. What's the old joke? How can you tell if an engineer is an extrovert?
I know this one.
He stares at your shoes
instead of his own. Yeah.
Right. You know, and but they do, like, there is like a personality type self-selection that goes on. And a lot of what we do with tools, I was watching the video about, you know, BDD and things like that. Right. We're trying to come up with technical solutions to the problem of ambiguity and not understanding what we're doing. And yes, one of the things that made me fall in love with Agile is the idea that what you do is you go talk to people, like just go ask them.
Yep.
So John Kern couldn't make it. This first link is all about how he does BDD at his current job, which is real code. It's real feature driven development. If you're interested, check this out. But John and I had a little conversation offline. He asked us to critique it. I was like, John, this is textbook, like wonderful how to use the tools. I said, but BDD, ATDD, it's a business workflow. These tools just sort of help you do the thing you would have to do otherwise. And he was like, well, you know, could you elaborate on that a little bit? I'm like, well, you know, unless you understand what the manual work is, you'll just keep getting involved in making more and more complex stuff.
That's right. I'm going to automate bad stuff. You know, rather than, you know, using automation to help me build good stuff.
We used to go into shops, we're like, yeah, we've been using automated testing. The behavior testing, we're all good with that. And I'd go look at it and be like, user clicks button. Button turns bold. And I'm like, what in the hell are you doing? Oh, my God. And they're like, well, you know, the problem is our files keep getting too big. I go, yeah, I could see where there'd be a problem. Yeah. You're trying to do unit testing with a behavioral testing tool. It's no good.
That's how it works. Which is interesting, I mean, because the thing that I see in the real world, right, the thing I see in my client space is that the things they need, the technical interventions they need are baby steps. Right? If we could get them 10% or 15% along the way to automated testing, right, it would give them a 50% lift from where they are. And it's like they don't need to be black belts in any of this stuff, right? It's like if I can get them one level up, you know, that's a giant beginning.
Well, I think this sort of ties in with the BDD discussion that we were talking a couple of weeks back, that if you had to pick one metric, it would sort of be time between when somebody describes the problem and the fix is in production.
Yep.
And if you look at the system from that outside standpoint, just that one number, it'll drive out a bunch of other conversations about automated testing and how you're meeting with the customers, because you got to do it the right way to get it done quickly.
Yep.
You're talking about, there's been a little theme here of shorten the feedback loop, right? You know, so if we can, these little steps let you see the feedback loop. And I think the requirements getting blown out of proportion for that thing that you were talking about earlier, Dan. You know, if you only get to ask for something once a year with a long delivery cycle, you're going to ask for everything.
Yeah.
Well, James,
if you ask for something big, you can know what you need.
James has been working with this. James does embedded TDD. So he's been working with folks who have been insistent and been convinced for their entire career sometimes that you can't do fast feedback loops when you're doing embedded code. And so the whole...
Because you don't have hardware.
Because you don't have hardware, because, you know, it's too tough, yeah. It's too technical. And the beauty of what you're doing there, and I sat in on your course once, it was just, okay, guys, we can mock up what we need, and we can still go through this feedback loop where we make the code where we want it, and then we're fine. We can go on to the next thing.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
James, I might want to kind of connect some of your materials over with what one of my kids is doing. He has a startup in kind of edge computing and machine vision. And I think, you know, things that would make his feedback loops tighter would probably be good for him. Although he's at the point where he seldom listens to me anymore, and he sort of has it down. But
yeah, maybe you should recommend against him seeing James.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, whatever you do, don't read this book. It's awful. Again,
yeah. So the small steps you mentioned, baby steps or tiny steps. And I think in the context you're talking about, they need a small step improvement. And one of the things that I've come to appreciate over, you know, now two decades of writing tests and that sort of thing, about halfway through those two decades, it's like, you know, the really powerful thing is these small steps.
Yeah.
Tests, it's great because then you can repeat the small steps over and over, over again for free. But if I'm working in an area where I can't really write a test, I can still work in small steps, you know. And that I can get that feedback, and I don't leave behind a huge trail of mistakes, you know, all interacting with, you know, maybe my system works by accident because of all the mistakes offsetting. But, you know, if you work in these small steps, you know why something did something.
You know, I've had the experience a couple times, and it got sort of frustrating in my career that I would do a talk or a class for a week or whatever, and everybody would be agreeing with whatever I said, and, you know, it would be wonderful. And I don't think they were blowing me off. I think they actually understood and believed in what was going on. I think the Scrum Master class is a good example of that. Do the thing, and everybody was happy, and then they would leave, and, you know, nothing would happen. And as I started chasing that down and debugging it, the problem was they understood the high concept, but they didn't know what that little bit was to do next. And so once they went back to the team room, like, okay, I got all these kind of cool ideas. Okay, what do I do now? And that they just sort of fell apart at that point.
What's the simple, immediate thing I can do? There's two great books, and I have a horrible habit, and I enrage people regularly. Yeah. My answer to everything is, oh, read this book. Like, this book has
you're not one of those, are you? Oh, my God.
Well, Dan works for a good publisher.
Company,
Mark. Sort of like, you know, I have a garbage can mind, and I remember what I read. And so, like, you know, I tend to, like, go, oh, that's in that book. You should read that book. And I can sort of pull the stuff off the shelf. The two books are, there's a book called Little Bets, which is an awesome book about the idea that you're talking about on, like, how do I stay in the game with little bets and then find the bets that work and grow them rather than making these giant bets, right, and putting everything at risk.
Manage your money. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other one is The Systems Bible by John Gall, which is hysterically funny. And it's too seldom read.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Right? It's like one of these things where, like, very few of the people I meet at work, right, in my professional life have read it. My techie friends all have read it and kind of, you know, adore it and worship it. Oh, he's got a paper copy.
There you go. It's not signed.
Do you know how much those things go to Libris now? And, you know, for $12 on Kindle.
Oh, wow. Well, John Gall died like 2 years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He was friends with, who's the guy?
Beyond Budgeting guy?
Again?
The Beyond Budgeting guy?
No, you saw him in the, Gil.
Who was that? Who was that, James?
Tom Gilb. Gilb.
Tom
yeah,
Gilb.
Friend. So, yes.
Yeah, there's another book along those lines. It's about forming tiny habits. Came out about a year or two ago. It's a tiny habit. How to make small habits turn into big changes in your life, which is sort of a similar idea.
It's called habit stacking, and it's this that I'm trying to break right now in my agile practice. Which is, write a day. I can go and I can make mechanical changes in an org, and I can honestly generate improvement. I earn my keep in the orgs that I go to, as far as I'm concerned. But we don't have the win that we're all kind of looking for because we can't change the culture.
Yes. Yes.
And
have you heard? Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Have you heard this saying? It's easier to act your way into thinking differently than to think your way into acting differently.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I find that, you know, for programmers doing TDD, it's like I rely on that. You know, it's like if you could think about test-driven and not get it, but if you started to do it by going through the actions, you start to understand it.
100%.
And then, this is maybe why the practice you're talking about, Mark, is the right road, because if you get people in this and for their problems, I don't know. I'm not a culture guy. I wish these people are messy.
Messy and complex. So I wrote a thing a while ago on sort of what I see as the religious war within Agile right now, right? Which is procedural versus right behavioral Agile.
Mm.
Right? There's procedural folks who are the technical Agile folks and the safe folks, right? And there's the cultural Agile folks who are, we should never make a team Agile unless the team wants to be Agile, right? We should basically like eliminate all oppression within organizations.
Yes.
is essentially what they're trying to get to. And Agile as a liberating force is kind of the way I talk about it. And I point out that like both of them are consistently failing.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. The procedural folks build their procedure, they run up against the culture, and they basically flatline. And they talk about what you talk about, James, which is we're going to have people act this way, and then they're going to grow into doing it, you know, innately. But they don't build a ladder for them to actually do that.
Sure. Maybe. I just work with engineers, so, you know, it's like I can get a win easier because if an engineer's life gets better, then, you know, a bell rings.
Right. I don't use the A word anymore, and I at least try not to. And the reason why, and I don't want to dump too much on our group, because I have some dear friends that are coaches and technical coaches, but I just don't see any progress in that whole area. I think we're still having the same conversations we were having 20 years ago. And it's just,
I think so. And I think,
I'm not going to do another. I don't do it anymore. I'm sorry. I quit.
Well, I think that what happens is we had a positive impact. We did a good thing. Right. But that good thing is done. And there's a part of us that always wants to like relive the glory days, right? You know, and we want to like, you know, keep it rolling. But in fact, like they've kind of absorbed the learnings, right? They're not necessarily doing them well, and we can improve them. And there's room for progress. And I'll get paid for as long as I want to keep working to keep turning that dial. But at the end of the day, I think it's time for something different.
Yeah, well, James and I, after we finished last week, we kind of talked about kind of what I've been up to the last 2 or 3 years. And I honestly don't mean this as a plug, and I try to avoid any sort of commercial stuff here. But what I've been doing is trying to come up with a calculus of product development, basically. It's sort of an abstract language of how we solve problems, and then we can use that language with whatever tools and processes we want. And the reason why is I was just unfulfilled with both management text and Agile text, and all of it seemed to have sort of a different viewpoint, and none of it actually seemed to sort of go all the way to the other side.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's the case. And I think that, I don't know, I think it's kind of an exciting time because I think that there is an immense need for organizations to change. I don't know about you all, but I keep going into these organizations and I come home and I cry softly at night worrying that like the lights are going to shut off because nobody can actually manage anything in this world.
Yes.
It's all working by accident, I'm pretty sure.
Right, pretty much. You know, and it's like, we got to help these organizations get better. And the other part of it is how unhappy people are. Because people know that they're part of an organization that's not, you know, thriving.
I think that there's one little thing that's missing now that we paid a lot of attention to 20 years ago. Is, you know, when you were talking to an organization, thinking about adopting extreme programming 20 years ago, they were thinking we had some problems we wanted to solve. And, you know, if they would be open about the problems they're trying to solve, we could look at creative ways to help solve those. And I don't, you know, I see a lot of people just pushing. You mentioned safe, and you're calling it technical agile. I would have a different definition for technical agile. I think there's three parts here. Maybe we're missing one, but we would go in and we would, you know, a bunch of engineers. It's like, what problems are we trying to solve? And then, okay, you know, we might be able to improve that one with these changes of how we work. Let's go try that. And I don't hear anybody asking what problem you're trying to solve. It's like, you better use SAFe, or you better use Scrum, or your sprints don't produce enough story points, or whatever.
Something that might help think of, sort of move forward on this is, if you think about it from the standpoint of the average employee, and if you go to a startup that's only got maybe 3 or 5 employees, they're pretty forthright, and they'll tell you directly what they're doing, what's wrong, what, you know, how they want to get there. That's one of the reasons I love doing these Nerd Roundups. But what you learn as you get to that 20 to 50 kind of employee range is you don't make waves.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to 200-300 people, people who make waves are punished in various ways, usually passively, aggressively, or whatever. But the culture becomes just don't rock the boat. And it's not that they're trying to hurt themselves, but it just sort of snowballs to the point, by the time the managers are calling you to say, hey, we have a problem, the building's on fire. I mean, it's bad.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know if you guys know Alex Yakima. A crazy, brilliant Ukrainian mathematician who came over and went to work with Dean Leffingwell. And he actually wrote kind of big parts of like SAFe 3 and 4.
I think I've met Alex, yep.
And a really, really brilliant guy, and I love him. And he wrote a book. He kind of went 90 degrees from SAFe and wrote an interesting book about outcomes-driven, kind of the outcomes-driven organization. But he has this word for the kind of organization you're describing. He says it's a semiconductor organization. Right? Because basically orders transmit readily downward. Good news transmit readily upward, but bad news doesn't go anywhere.
It's like a diode for bad news.
And part of it too is that humans by definition sort of use vague and loose language to avoid confrontation. And I mean, that's just the way we're wired. And so if you're in a tight group of startup guys, you're going to be very direct. And or even if you're not direct, people know you well enough to know what you're really talking about. But, you know, as you start scaling that out, that vagueness becomes sort of social protection for you because you don't have to have fights with everybody in the org. But then it becomes sort of a bunch of mush for everybody else to deal with.
Have you read Ray Dalio's books? The hedge fund guy?
Yes, I've read a couple of those.
So he's the hedge fund guy who sort of built this culture around like radical honesty, and supposedly like his organization is sort of like a cult, right? But it's one of these things where he built a series of social enforcement mechanisms to drive people to be kind of like that honest and transparent. And I think it's, you know, and it's also the Project Aristotle, the Google thing about psychological safety.
Yes. Right.
You know, it's the whole game. From my point of view,
I think what happens, and this gets back to your two camps sort of analogy, is that we realize, and I think everybody's able to have this sort of, oh, well, it's just people being honest with one another. But taking that to the next step, kind of what does that actually mean in the real world means, you know, we have to have some mechanism to have disagreements at a large scale, which is exactly the problem social media is having right now.
And the issue is that there's this fundamental presumption of good faith that when you have psychological safety, there's a presumption of good faith.
Yes.
Right. That if I tell you your baby's ugly, I'm telling you as a friend to kind of help you deal with whatever the consequences of that are. Right. And I'm not telling you that as a way of, you know, belittling you.
Yes.
Or sort of, you know, making myself one up on you.
Yeah, I was talking about that this morning. I was on one of the intellectual dark web forums. And the discussion was hyperbole, and you know how frustrating it is to read something that's just so far over the top online. And once people were called out on it, they say, "Oh, it's just hyperbole." Well, you know, the thing is context and intent matters.
Yeah.
So if you and I are having a disagreement or some tool or some sort of goal we commonly hold, I will use hyperbole as a way to sort of limit in the conversation to try to figure out exactly what the hell kind of problem we're talking about.
Yeah.
But if we were in this. Same two people were having an argument, I would use hyperbole as a way of sort of dissing you.
That's right.
And online, it's Poe's Law. Online, you just can't tell one way or another.
No, you can't. And I think that the I'm gonna fork the conversation real quickly, and I want to come back, James, and say that I violently agree about anchoring in the customer problems. And the biggest successes that I've had in doing kind of my agile-ish transformation work have been when I literally opened the conversation with them about, hey, let's do a SWOT. Right? Let's define where your organization is.
That's
right.
Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats.
Operate opportunities and threats,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
And then I'm going to teach you some stuff about lean and agile. And then we're going to round up at the end of this, and we're going to come back, and we're going to see if there's anything in this lean and agile stuff we can apply to your SWOT. And those things will be our priority to go do.
Yeah.
And those are the most successful kind of workshops that I run. And it's frustrating to me that I can't get clients to do it more often. Right? Because they tend to be like, I want that. You know, it's the classic problem where I walk into the store and I know what I want. So I'm like, don't talk to me. Just give me that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the biggest issues with being a consultant, and I've talked about this many times, is you're really being paid by the person you're supposed to come in and tell they're wrong.
Well, I have another phrase, which is earning the right to a conversation.
Well, yeah, and that's how you would get to tell them they're wrong. But my point being is that there, people already think they know the problem, and they just want to put the quarter in the machine and have the soda come out.
The solution. I'm like, you know, owning a Peloton doesn't make you safe.
Damn it.
Doesn't make you fit.
Doesn't make you fit. Damn it.
I think my breakfast is about to show up. Hi, Dave.
I've got two Fitbits I wear at the same time because I'm serious.
I'm twice as fit.
Yeah. And you mentioned your consulting transitions that work great. I'll tell you my horror story. Now I'm much better at making sure that my clients are ready. I went down to this client on a referral from a friend, and I get there and I did my usual thing. It's like, okay, so what problems are we trying to solve? And everybody in the room starts looking at each other with their arms crossed. Like, no, we don't. Problems? Everything's great here. It's like, well, you know, usually when somebody hires me, it's there's some problem that you guys are looking to solve. It's like, no, that's not us. We didn't actually want you to be here. It was our great grandboss that had hired you.
So I had this gig in Austin, Texas, I think about 4 years ago. Big, big multinational company, which I will not name. And I went down there, was going to do technical coaching, TDD, and also process stuff, maybe a little safe. They're interested in a little bit of everything. So I get there, and I realize over the period of the first day or week or so that everything was completely fine, and nobody had anything. So I kept wandering around trying to find somebody who would actually, like, why am I here? Right. And I finally found the girl. She was a QA lead, and she had been in a meeting the previous month or whatever. She's like, well, why don't we just bring in a technical coach? Boom, here I am. It's like, yeah, probably not the recipe for success.
No, it's not. And it's a challenge. And I think, you know, one of the challenges, and now I'm going to turn it around and let me, you know, one of the challenges in our industry is that we've got to figure out what coaches are for.
Yes.
And what the standards of being a coach are.
Yes.
And that, you know, I've probably interviewed, you know, I don't know, 1,000 coaches. Right, because I've run a couple big transformations and I've talked to a lot of people. And what I find is kind of three things about coaches. One is, in the same sense that engineering attracts a certain kind of person, coaching attracts a certain kind of person.
Bingo, yeah.
Right. And those people tend to be passionate about, you know, the qualities and the social issues around Agile and the transformative nature of it.
These are movement
and
people.
I always use the word religious.
Yes.
Right. And the other thing that I notice is that there's a very, very small percent of them that have ever actually built much.
John Kern and I were talking, and I hope John is okay with me mentioning this a week or two ago after we shut the camera down. And, you know, John is a very direct person. I love talking with John because he's a tech guy, codes every day, he doesn't cut a lot of corners. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, John, part of the problem here is that we don't know how to manage technology development. We just don't know how to manage it. And so if you walk into a shop that needs maybe a team of 5 and has 100 people, really, what do you realistically expect it to do? You know, you don't want to have some massive culling. And so being a technical coach in general, how do you guys feel about, solitaire, everybody. Like,
yeah.
So if you're really honest with yourself and you realize that there's this much waste in the system you're looking at, then you're faced with this sort of moral and ethical dilemma. It's like, well, how do I you know, approach the customer. You know, 95, you guys got to go because we don't need you. And because of it's that ethical dilemma, it does attract the people that just ignore the whole dilemma entirely. It's okay, if we're all just happy and we'll be
right
100 times more. It's like, no, actually adding more people, whether they're happy or not, doesn't make the system work any better.
No, and I think that's a big piece of it. And I think the other kind of piece of it is that, you know, we do have these organizations that build these giant sort of body farms, right, about, you know, about getting work done. And the reality is a lot of times I look at this and I'm like, you've got 60 people working on this. I bet you'd get more done with 8.
Yes.
So how do you solve that problem? And I don't have kind of an answer. I think what you try and do is you try and enlighten people, right? You try and get them to see the idea. You try and shard the problem a little bit.
I think part of this, you know, it gets into problem solving. I'm going to try to keep the analogy with coding here, is that good organizations identify a problem, do the analysis around the problem, flounder around, you know, because confusion, chaos, they finally get some system to address the problem, they codify that system, they automate that codification, and they move on. And that's painful. That's just like coding and cleaning up while you code. That's a painful thing to do too, but they don't go back to that problem anymore. Poor organizations run into a problem, they thrash around a little bit, they hire somebody, that person becomes that problem, and then they go on, and everybody else goes on and does something else. And that's just a that's non-sustainable. It's not going to work over time.
Well, it can be sustainable. So I'll tell you a funny story. I worked for an org, and I'm not going to name them because, you know, they're bigger than me and they would squash me. But I worked for a company that was founded by a couple of guys that didn't believe in computers.
Oh, cool.
And they very much liked attractive women. And so basically the company made ungodly amounts of money, right? They were in the right business at the right time. And so what they did was they built all these processes which were effectively manual. And every time they bottlenecked on a process, they'd hire this really bright. I mean, these women are super, super capable, right? They would hire because they pay them tons of money, right? And they would hire this woman, and she would sit at her desk, and she would have Excel up and maybe an Access database and a stack of paper this big on one side and a stack of paper this big on the other side, and she's solving the problem.
Yes. And that's a good example because
they have 5 floors in a building.
Full of attractive people.
Right, with all these, like, and they have, like, people shuttling paper around, right? And so, you know, they were looking at automating it at some point. But
you don't have, like, after we talk, I'd like to just
make a name. But the short version of it is, it worked for them.
Dan, you want to get a side job over there.
Well, that's a beautiful story. And the reason why is that being an attractive woman just is a proxy for any number of things, right? They believe
it is.
The same religious thing, whatever. You could just plug in whatever your thing is.
I'm hiring my fellow Mormons. I'm hiring whoever I want to hire. But the key is that you can make these things work if you have enough money. And if your business is successful enough, you can run it any way you want.
Sure. Yep.
The issue becomes, you know, what happens when you have a downturn? What happens when you're not successful? And the other thing that happens is for the average run-of-the-mill business that's just trying to make it by, what do you do?
So I've got to tell this story, and I apologize for the brief digression. But I was working, this 15, 20 years back, and I was running 2 teams, and one of the people on my teams, brilliant guy, he claimed he had worked with Apple and Microsoft, and he was really smart, and he could talk a good game, but he was obnoxious and impossible to get along with. And so we tried for a while, and, you know, it's just, wow, this guy's so smart, we just can't make it work. And then one day he comes in and he's got this just drop dead gorgeous girl with him, and they're all talking or whatever. And I'm like, "What? Who? Do we hire somebody? What?" He's like, "No, he brought his girlfriend with him to try to help him keep his job." And she was brilliant, but she was also very attractive. I'm like, you know, I'm beginning to like that guy a lot better now. I think maybe we could spend a little more time. I think
you're
maybe.
Actually, I have a really strong pattern on that because I've had a lot of teams where I've had that developer, you know, who's X times more productive than anybody else in the team, but destroys everybody else's productivity. And it's you start by sort of talking to them and addressing them as an adult and trying to make it work. then you basically put them in a room and you slip work under the door. Right. And basically firewall them off from everybody else in the team. And when that stops working, you fire them.
It's funny. And I've done been down that road as well. There's a flip side of that pattern. And that is the person who has very little technical skills. But if you add them to any team, it seems like the whole team starts working like two or three times faster.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I've totally hired that person too. And you and I have watched them in detail trying to figure out what is it that they do that make no idea.
And I think and that's fine. I think that's just the way people work. What happens is you get a team like that succeeding, the first thing management wants to do is let's take the team apart and sprinkle these people on the other teams because they must have some sort of magic dust on them that will make everybody else better too.
I've done that with a client.
Then you get a bunch of people doing crap. It's like, hey, thanks.
Yeah. No, I went to a war with one of my clients over that exact argument. And I made a deal that what we would do instead is we would roll people through the team two at a time. Right. So that they would bring other people into this team.
Yep.
And they would stay for 6 weeks and then we'd roll them out. And that proved to be actually relatively successful.
I've also done the this comes into play a lot with SAFE and the program level stuff is you do like a 6-person team. They run. You get a good rhythm going. Then you go 2-3-person teams. Then you add people to those 3-person teams and you sort of do a tree thing.
And you keep budding the teams.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I know it's weird. I missed delivering stuff.
Oh, yeah. I think the delivering stuff keeps you honest. The problem with communicator people, such as I think you and perhaps me, the problem a lot of people in our organization that what we do is that it's so easy to give the appearance that you're actually sort of making progress or doing, but you're not really. And delivering stuff kind of cuts to the bone on either it's coming out the other end or not.
Or not. And it's another book, Shop Class as Soulcraft, that I cannot recommend highly enough.
Okay, so, and please keep the book, I'm just going to poke at you a little bit. If you would like to hear me curse at you directly, just keep the book stuff. I've got friends, like I'll be chatting and I am like, hey, what do you think about, oh, you know, you should read. I'm like, you shut the, I will give it to like, I got, and then I'll come back and I'll recommend books back to them. It's like, you killed last weekend with this thing, gee. It's like taking an alcoholic and like, hey, let's go pick up some beers. Like, no, bad.
But yeah, my wife has now a new rule, which is that for every book that enters the house, a book must leave.
My wife was like, you know, Daniel, you've got 30 books in your to read stack that I bought you for Christmas that you never read, and then you've got another 30 books that you bought yourself in your stack.
Oh my God. Yeah, one day you'll have time for those, Dan.
That's right.
One more. But I think
the question really. I'm going to go back to the question of delivery, and I have an idea that I want to bounce off the two of you. I believe that every Agile coach should take a sabbatical every couple of years and go do delivery. You know, be a project manager, be a scrum master, be an RTE, be in some accountable delivery role.
Yes.
Where you spend 6 months or 9 months, you know, a long enough in a cycle to matter, and you actually kind of get your hands dirty and see stuff work.
I've tried to come up with a sort of a quick
good idea.
I tried to come up with a quick phrase for folks, and this applies to sort of political discussions online and Agile, and that is political systems exist for political reasons. And so, if you're in a delivery team where there is some physical feedback loop, you either sell the apples you're making or you don't. Mm-hmm. That's independent of you and your feelings and how people whether they like you or not. Whereas, if you just move out a level from that, maybe you're a program manager, whatever, suddenly. That loop becomes what people think about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can justify that with charts and metrics. And of course, we all know how data entry, how data driven many CFOs are, CEOs. But at the end of the day, it's a political system that you're then working for instead of actually a physical system. And that tends to sort of feed on itself over time.
So two things. One is you just perfectly summarized Shop Class as Soulcraft.
Now you don't have to read it anymore.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Bam.
Right. And two is, I think that also explains some of the big divisions in the country. Right. And I'll tell a small personal story. Right. So when I came back to LA in the 80s, I lived on Venice Beach. Right. And then I lived in the Venice Canals, which is this sort of, you know, hipster like everybody's in some kind of information business, right? We're in tech or we're in movies or we're in music, or that's kind of, you know, everybody makes their living with symbols, right?
Yes.
And then I got sort of forced to move down here to get custody of my sons, right? And I now live in the South Bay, kind of, you know, in a nice suburb near the beach. And everybody here has an airplane or a car in their garage that they're working on.
Right?
And I was very unhappy when I first moved here, right? Because I'm like, I don't have good restaurants. I don't have my culture. I'm not with my people. And then I had this moment of realization that if you took my friends in Venice who have a million airline miles and can tell you where to buy cheese in London and Paris, right? Go to that store. That's a really good store. And you put them on an island with a broken airplane, tools, parts, and food for 6 months, they would die.
Yeah.
Right? If you put the people from where I live now on that island, the airplane would be fixed in 2 weeks. They'd be taking it flying around the world, right? You know what I mean?
Yes.
And they'd have made like 20 improvements to it because like, oh, this is really not the way it ought to be. Let's make it better.
Problem solvers.
Yeah. Well, different kinds of problem solvers.
Yeah.
Or they'd have a perfect airplane that that wouldn't fly, but it would be gorgeous because everybody agreed that this was the most awesome airplane ever.
Well, the ones in Venice. The people here would build one that actually
flew. Okay.
Yeah, I'm wondering if continuous delivery, you know, kind of this big deal today, could have a reverse impact on the processes that feed it, right? You know, so the more emphasis on let's continuously deliver things, the better controls they're going to have of the better results they need to get from the processes that feed them. And will people have to grow up a bit and figure and start focusing on problem solving to make that work?
So this is the conversation I have when I do org change. And that is, okay, guys, you're bringing me in because there's some symptoms you're feeling. I don't think these symptoms are probably representative of actually what the problem is. So we're going to set up a metric, probably continuous delivery.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about this metric until you're uncomfortable. And once I reach a spot where you're like, okay, Daniel, you're right, but I can't make that change. At that point, our engagement is over because I've identified those sort of process changes that you could make. And if we don't ever reach that spot, I'm not doing my job, frankly. This is the valley. This is the valley of death they talk about with startups. God, what was that book? Anyway, there's a whole thing about how you can do really great at first, but then you enter this sort of valley where the personalities of the founders themselves actually start constraining where the org can go. And it happens at program level, happens at the division level. You got to say, hey, guys, okay, you're at the cliff now. If you've got to push through the valley or stop, pick one.
Yeah. And I think the issue becomes, what I love about things like when I can actually get people and start doing automated testing in CI/CD, it highlights all the constraints upstream of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, my thing is I talk a lot about left of do.
Yes.
Right? Because I get hired all the time by companies that are like, those developers take so long to get anything in production, right? Like, how can you make them faster?
Huh.
And one of the things I try and do is I'll do like a retrospective on like something that was delivered last year. So we delivered this in October of 2020. Great. It went into development in March of 2020. It was funded in January of 2020. It was proposed in November of 2018.
The pain.
Those darn engineers taking so long.
Like 7 months, right? It was in planning for a year and a half, but you want me to compress the 7 months, right? So you get it faster. Why don't we compress the year and a half?
Yeah. Oh, we got to have a good gateway process. The thing is, yeah, you have to have a good, what is your product owner team? No, you have to have a good gateway process to make sure only the correct things come in. It used to be the change control board we had, right?
Yeah.
There's no way to get back that time you wasted at the beginning.
That's right. It's also the cheapest stuff to fix, if you think about it.
If you go down the wrong path or if you...
Well, just in general, it's like making that process efficient is a smaller group of people, right, than the development teams. So I can have a bigger impact on that smaller group of people with less effort than I can on the development teams if they're willing to play.
You might not be able to separate them, though, because there's experiment. You know, if somebody's got really a novel new idea, you need to experiment to find out what can we do there, right?
Oh, but again, I'm not talking about the experimentation. I'm talking about in most organizations, the run-up from somebody surfacing an idea to a decision maker to, resources being committed to the idea to actually go do something with it.
Yeah, sure.
That chunk of time is chunk of time that we tend to ignore when we look at process improvement.
Yeah.
One of the things you can do that's kind of a real quick gimme, real quick low-hanging fruit, is just flatten every damn thing you can, either from the top down or the bottom up. One of the things I've done in safe teams is like, okay, guys, if you have a problem, put it on your wall. I mean, physically write something. I don't care what it is—a picture, of like your ball. I don't care. Yeah. You don't have to solve the problem. But if you continue having a problem, make a visual representation of it on your wall. And then anybody in the org can come out and do a walk of all the teams and see what problems they're facing. Will I ever have to have a conversation with you? And a very similar thing can happen with product teams and programs as well. If you can use a publish subscribe method, especially if it's done in a physical manner, it just cuts out a whole bunch of stuff, meetings and a bunch of stuff you really do not need.
Yeah. Cutting out meetings is a big thing that I do. I did an assessment for this company early in the year, and they're asking what like the most impactful thing they could do.
Hello,
was. I said, hey, dude.
Hello, nerds.
They're high nerds. Oh no!
Awesome.
Hey, cute.
Right, but I said the most impactful thing you could do is audit your standing meetings and get rid of
problems.
Time to work.
Yes. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I just tell people you should have a meeting-free environment, and that freaks them out. And then we're like, okay, why do you have to have? Here's a good rule of thumb: if you're going to a meeting that you know how it's going to end, don't have the meeting.
Yeah.
Meetings you go to should be, golly, we have to do this thing. I have no idea what's going to come out of this.
You saw the Elon Musk thing about meetings, didn't you?
So I've read so much.
It was like, if you don't know why you're going to a meeting, don't go.
Don't go.
If you're in a meeting and there's no reason for you to be there, get up and walk out.
Yes.
We had that rule at Object Mentor back in 2000.
I love it.
Yep. I cut down on the meetings.
I'm still amazed at the difference I saw at the program level between an open space where teams are managing their own and teams locally manage their environment, but yet it's an open space all around, and the meeting culture where people leave a cube and they go to a room somewhere where that just there's a night and day difference.
Well, it's the conversation. One of my tells for healthy teams is if you walk into the space, there's a lot of lateral conversation, spontaneous lateral conversation going on, right? If they're all talking to one person, right? Or one person's doing all the talking to them, right? Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. I've had scrum masters I've threatened to throw out of their own team because it's all a one. I'm like, his name was Jim. Jim, you got to shut up. I mean, you just can't do this anymore. This is not working. And he did. The weird thing is he just didn't get it because to him, he was trying to facilitate like them identifying their own problem. Like, no, you're not. You're pushing instead of like you should be receiving.
Yeah. The couple of things about Scrum bother me. And one is that micromanagement tendency that the daily meetings cause to have happen.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the other thing is calling them sprints, which I think just gets the mind going the wrong direction.
The thing I love, and by love I mean hate, the most about Scrum is the fact that they start off with, we're completely role-free. It's a cross-functional team. We don't have roles. The next breath, they will tell you, well, of course, we have a product.
Here's your Scrum Master.
Here's the Scrum Master. It's like, wink, wink. You know, you guys used to be project managers.
I'll defend those things a little bit in that, the premise is I'm now in a big organization where the customer can't be paraded in front of the team.
But you're addressing should we have like the go-to guy to be whatever.
Right. And that effectively becomes the product owner. And I think other thing is that, I like the idea of sprints. And the reason I like the idea of sprints is I like little bets.
Well, I like the idea of sprints too, but I don't like the word sprint because I've watched the Olympics. And you know what the sprinters do after they finish their sprint?
Right.
They collapse. And then if you want them to get up and do another one, I mean, that's not the way the Olympics do it. But right. So I just think it's the wrong metaphor.
I had a difficult time.
It's given people in the world a huge, this is one of my pet peeves, by the way. It's given people in the world this idea that Agile's only about, let's make sure we go fast. Don't go well. Just go fast.
Right. Yeah, it's the old thing about the person lost in the woods and they're just now they're running instead of walking. It's like, but I'm going fast. I'm still lost.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Going in circles or.
we don't have a good way of knowing when we should not be writing code. Nobody ever teaches tech teams about how not to make, how to solve a problem without tech.
So this is the question that I sort of think about, right?
Hey, Dan, I'm running out of time here.
Okay.
So it's the thing I think about. My dad built high-rise buildings in the 60s and 70s, right? So $20 to $30 million budget, 150 people for 2 years, kind of was like a typical project scope. And if one of his buildings was sort of 10% over schedule and budget, somebody took their stuff home in a box.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody lost their job.
Yeah.
Right? We're incapable of consistently delivering within 30 or 40% of schedule and budget in our industry. And that makes me crazy.
Well, just think about how we do our training, Mark. The thing
I wonder
is
about
is that
building design. How about in building design? Does building design work on a perfectly timed schedule? Because really, we're not talking about the construction phase. Our construction phase is fast. You push the build button.
Our that's a good point.
Invention stage is the thing that takes time, right? Or the design of the building, is it on a schedule, a timetable that doesn't vary? Or is that the thing that happened in the beginning that we're not going to pay attention to? You know, so in development, you're pretty much inventing the whole time.
Yes.
And then you push the compile button. And, you know, the building we've got down, that's automated.
So I think I'll make a distinction, which is I think that the building of it is the equivalent of, you know, what we call design. And I think that one of the reasons why that I think explains it is that I could pick somebody up from one of my dad's jobs in the 1970s and drop them on a job site today, right? And with not a lot of spool up, they would be functional and they would get what was going on.
Right? Sure, but then the creation of those plans that they're executing is different than what we're working with.
But the creation of the plans, but so let's talk about, you know, typically the design of a building goes through three phases, right? It goes through what's called conceptual design, which is, this is going to be a 30-story high rise. It's going to be roughly rectangular. It's going to be sited like this on the site. And it's going to have kind of these outbuildings, and we're going to deal with parking and infrastructure this way. Right. Yep. And those are pencil sketches basically on paper.
Right.
And then what you have to do is you have to devolve that down to a detailed architectural design, which is what it's going to look like. And then you take the architectural design and you devolve it down to a bunch of basically working drawings, which talk about where's the steel going to go, where do the pipes go, where do the wires go, where do the elevators go, how does this all work?
And I think that's the wrong metaphor. I got you. But the thing is that, you know, where is the problem solved? Where is that conceptual discussion kind of should cascade all the way down to the guy typing in the code, but it doesn't. And instead, at some point, the conceptual talk stops, who knows where, and everybody beneath that thinks they're just kind of going through the motions of working, you know, process X with tool Y and whatever.
And I think you're right. I think that there in buildings, there's a readily comprehensible chain from concept to concrete.
It's a physical thing.
Right, it's a physical thing. I go look at it. Right? In software, that chain is very sketchy right now. And something that connected that chain, which sounds like something like the project you're working on, might be very interesting.
Okay, guys, give me a second. Let me wrap this up, and I'll come back, and I'll tell you guys goodbye. So I have to do my end of show thing. All right. Okie dokie. You've wasted yet a completely good hour that you could have spent becoming a doctor or doing something useful with your life, but no, instead you had to drop by Nerd Roundup and goof off with us. We're thankful you came by, and we will see you on the internet.